Good morning. My name is Max Ramirez, and I will be reading the Pantograph today, August 27th, 2024. Top headline is the weather, and safety is urged amid the heat wave. From Bloomington, high temperatures and humidity sprawled across central Illinois on Monday, and meteorologists warn the heat wave is expected to continue throughout the week. The National Weather Service issued a heat advisory Monday for most of Illinois, and an excessive heat warning will be in effect from 11 a.m. until 8 p.m. Tuesday in McLean County, Woodford, Tazewell, Mason, Logan, DeWitt, Macon, Piatt, Champaign, Vermilion, Marshall, Cass, Menard, Scott, Morgan, and Sangamon counties all under a heat advisory. Temperatures are expected to peak in the upper 90s on Tuesday, tapering slowly to highs in the mid-80s with scattered thunderstorms on Friday, thanks in part to a cold front driving down the temperatures and humidity, according to the National Weather Service. Heat index values, what the weather will feel like to the human body, are forecasted to reach up to 114 degrees this week, which could cause an increase in heat-related illnesses. The Weather Service advises drinking plenty of fluids, especially water, and staying hydrated and indoors with air conditioning when possible. Stay out of the sun and remember to check on relatives and neighbors during this extreme weather. Even with the high temperatures, local public works crews are continuing with regularly scheduled work this week. Catherine Murphy, Bloomington's communication and external affairs manager, said that crews are already on a shortened schedule during this summer, and no projects are going to be paused due to the weather. Kathy Olson, Normal's communication director, said the town's public works crews routinely work from 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. in the summer to avoid the high heat and do not need to adjust their schedules. The town's human relations staff will be distributing cold water and Gatorade to the teams and crews on Tuesday, Olson said. Employees from both municipalities are encouraged to take appropriate precautions when drinking water, taking breaks, and using available shade to cool down. And they are reminded to watch the symptoms of heat exhaustion and what to do in situations where it occurs. Leslie Bunge, Director of Development at Home Sweet Home Ministries, said during these hot days, the staff at the Bloomington shelter will be offering water and access to showers on Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday to people living without permanent shelter. The Junction, located at 301 Oakland Avenue in Bloomington, is available from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. for people to get out of the heat, relax, get something to cool down, and drink, Bunge said. With the school year underway, both McLean County Unit 5 and Bloomington District 87 are marking adjustments to outdoor activities with classes, extracurricular activities, games, and practices. According to a post on Facebook from Unit 5, there are no recesses or physical education activities held outdoor on and the afternoon Monday for all of schools. All athletic events and outdoor practices were canceled for the junior highs on Monday and Tuesday. We are doing this with the safety and well-being of our students in mind. Our top priority is to ensure that all junior high students remain safe and healthy during a period of extreme weather, according to the Unit 5's post. District 87 Director of Communications, Genia Lavaz, said principals at each elementary school will decide on whether to hold any recesses or physical education classes inside, and coaches at Bloomington's junior high schools and high school are communicating with any and all changes with practices and games with families and students. And now to agriculture. Scientists studying the bird flu in cows as the USDA seeks vaccine as an outbreak has spread. In Ames, Iowa, at first glance, it looks like an unassuming farm. Cows are scattered across fenced-in fields. A milking barn sits in the distance with a tractor parked alongside it. The people who work there are not farmers, and other buildings look more like what you'd find at a modern university than in a cow pasture. Welcome to the National Animal Disease Center, a government research facility in Iowa where 43 scientists work with pigs, cows, and other animals, pushing to solve the bird flu outbreak currently spreading through U.S. animals and develop ways to stop it. Particularly important is the testing of cow vaccine designed to stop the continued spread of the virus. thereby and hopefully reducing the risk that it will someday become a widespread disease in people. The U.S. Department of Agriculture facility opened in 1961 in Ames, a college town about 45 minutes north of Des Moines. The center is located on a pastoral 523-acre site a couple of miles east of Ames, low-slung downtown. It's a quiet place with a rich history. Throughout the years, researchers there developed vaccines against various diseases that endangered pigs and cattle, including hog cholera, and worked there during the H1N1 flu pandemic in 2009, known at the time as swine flu. This proved the virus was contained only to the respiratory tract of pigs and that pork was, in fact, safe to eat. The center has the unusual resources and experience to do the kind of work, said Richard Webby, a prominent flu researcher at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in Memphis. That's not a capacity that many places in the U.S. have, said Webby, who has been collaborating with the Ames facility on the cow vaccine work. The campus has 93 buildings, including high-containment laboratory buildings whose exterior is reminiscent of a megachurch, but inside features a series of compartmentalized corridors and rooms, some containing infected animals. That's where scientists work with more dangerous germs, including the H5N1 bird flu. There's also a building where three floors of offices that houses animal disease researchers, as well as testing centers, that is, for animal versions of the CDC labs in Atlanta that identify rare and sometimes scary new human infections. About 660 people work at the campus, roughly a third of them assigned to the Animal Disease Center, which has been a $38 million annual budget. They were already busy with a wide range of projects, but grew even busier after the H5N1 bird flu unexpectedly jumped into the U.S. dairy population. It's just amazing how many people just dig down and make it work, said Mark Ackerman, the center's director. The virus was first identified in 1959 and grew into a widespread and highly lethal menace to migratory birds and domesticated poultry. Meanwhile, the virus evolved and in the past few years has been detected in a growing number of animals ranging from dogs and cats to sea lions and even polar bears. Despite the spread in different animals, scientists were still surprised this year when infections were suddenly detected in cows, specifically in the udders and milk of dairy cows. It's not unusual for bacteria to cause udder infections, but flu viruses? Typically, we think of influenza as being a respiratory virus, said Caitlin Saro Davila, a researcher at the Ames facility. Much of the research on the disease has been conducted at a USDA Poultry Researcher Center in Athens, Georgia, but the appearance of the virus in cows pulled the Ames Center into the mix. Amy Baker, a researcher who has won awards for her research in flu, preliminary results are expected soon, she said. USDA spokesperson Shiloh Weir called the work promising, but early in development. For Illinois Radio Readers, I'm Max Ramirez, and I appreciate you listening. Wish I could be with you longer. Hope to catch you next week. Thanks.
To step away for a few minutes, Kathy will finish your recording for today. This next article is on page 3, how three Bloomington Normal groups want to solve the community's housing crisis. Advocates looking for relief from the Twin Cities' ongoing housing crunch say that the solution may require creative development strategies and policy changes. Such initiatives were the subject of a Sunday afternoon forum at the Bloomington Public Library, where roughly 24 people gathered to discuss closing the gap between available, affordable housing stock and the number of people who need it. Participating organizations of the Thinking Outside the Box Housing Forum included the Bloomington Normal Community Land Trust, McLean County Co-Housing, and the Bloomin' Revivalists. Each were invited to present how they are involved in advocating for housing solutions, including building, affordability, and long-term sustainability. The forum was organized by the Bloomington Revivalists, a local conversation group recognized by national nonprofit advocacy nonprofit Strong Towns. Both the Revivalists and the Strong Towns have described themselves as seeking to replace the United States post-war suburban development patterns with an alternative that is financially strong and resilient. A Revivalist group member asked how to thread the needle between adding new housing in the existing market while preserving the flavor of the community. Noah Tang, a Bloomington resident and president of the local Revivalist group, said, "No neighborhood should be encased in glass. If you prevent change from happening, You have so much pent-up demand that something big is going to happen, Tang said. He said in West Coast cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco, a recently passed builder's remedy law overrode local zoning and permitted construction of buildings between 10 and 20 stories tall. Tang said the law is based on whether the number of homes in a neighborhood falls below the amount of needed housing. He said organizations like Strong Towns don't want to build apartment blocks or tall towers, but they do want to encourage smaller, multifamily housing like quadplex or duplex unit buildings. If you walk the street down Dimmitt's Grove neighborhood in Bloomington, you will notice there's not many things delineating an apartment building from a regular family home, other than the fact that there might be more than one mailbox box, Tang said. I think that's very important that you can still thread the needle of maintaining this neighborhood character. Attending the meeting was Georgine Chisel, Vice President of the Bloomington Normal Community Land Trust. In responding to Tang's above answer, Chisel said she grew up in a neighborhood where you could walk to everything. She said there was a YMCA, a pharmacy, laundromat, shoeshine business in the area, along with elderly neighbors who'd offered to babysit, and it was wonderful. The Revivalists. In his presentation, Tang said the Revivalists are not a political party, but they do advocate for their community to be safe, livable, and inviting. He said they also do community building efforts like trash pickup events. Tang said citizen developers have traditionally fostered walkability and gentle density, a term that refers to slightly increasing the number and variety of housing in traditional single-family neighborhoods. He said suburban development patterns drain more on taxpayers than their urban counterparts. If you take a look at the length of sewer lines, the length of streets actually needed to connect all these post-war developments, it costs a lot more money to maintain than the traditional, more compact designs, Tang said, adding that they want to go back to the latter development form. He defined infill development as the building or renovation of an urban core where infrastructure is already present and said they want those developments to carry through. Tang then reviewed a list of hurdles to those developments. He said the first barrier is the administration, process, and culture of a city or town. Others include zoning, financing, tax laws, fire codes, and building standards. Speaking generally in an interview, he said local government leaders may not welcome the type of development sought by his organization. Even when that's not the case, requirements to comply with rules around zoning, storm draining, utility easements, and other standards may prove too onerous for some. Mark Adams spoke on behalf of the Bloomington Normal Community Land Trust. He said the trust is still in its inception phases, having submitted its 501c3 paperwork in March, and is currently operating under an interim board. He said their mission is to retain and grow Bloomington Normal by providing affordable and varied housing through a land trust founded on equity, sustainability, and resiliency. Adams said the McLean County Regional Planning Commission recently adopted a call to support local land banks and land trusts, but no land banks are currently serving the county. He said a land trust is typically a nonprofit that owns land on behalf of the community, but that doesn't mean it buys a whole neighborhood or half a city. The trust removes a small parcel of land from a speculative market, Adams said, and would most likely sell it to an income-qualified prospective homeowner to construct a new building or renovate the existing. While the property could have sold at full market value, Adams said the land trust instead sells it for between 20 to 40% under value and substantially lowers mortgage payments for the buyer. It simply doesn't mean that they can't flip the home, he said, referring to a term used by investors who buy and construct or rebuild a home for the maximum profit possible. Adams said a land trust contract may limit appreciation allowed to buyer on a future sale by 25%, adding that cap rate can be flexible. He said the trust would still own the land, but the home buyers would be responsible for caring for the exterior and interior as a steward and could still paint the walls how they wish. Adams said they would also provide a volunteer squad for home improvement labor. Most land trusts don't do this. We're trying to be a bit more innovative and think outside the box, he said. He also said potential homeowners buying from the land trust will also require a home buyer's education. What differentiates a land bank from a land trust, he said, is a land bank as a solution for slower dead markets. The community land trusts thrive and are strong in hot housing markets where there's steady economic activity, where they're worried about long-term affordability, Adams said, and hence why we have started a land trust, co-housing. Renee Danger and Lauren Pruder spoke on behalf of the McLean County Co-Housing, which is seeking to form an LLC. Dagner said she joined the spring after Pruder started a group to study co-housing in January of 2023. Danger said that co-housing is a way to balance living in a community and maintaining personal privacy. While existing examples of co-housing do differ, she said such arrangements often feature a large common house surrounded by smaller homes and shared by everyone in the community. Common houses could also have amenities like a laundry room, large kitchen and dining areas, office spaces, and recreation room. Pruder said parking and cars will be kept to the side of the community to keep the internal area safe for children and other inhabitants to walk around. Building something like co-housing is a grand endeavor, but it has been done in cities very similar to ours, and we believe it can be done here. To start, she said, they first need to find committed people that are interested in co-housing, find land, finance the project, develop the site, move in, and govern. People in co-housing communities go through these steps themselves, she said, rather than paying an outside developer. She added that co-housing is not inherently minimalistic or based around religious or political ideology, and it does not require shared incomes. Pruder said her group meets monthly to share meals and look out for others' needs. Some of the things that our group really values is the long-term care for children and elderly with extended chosen family, Pruder said. We value shared joy and chores like gardening and cooking and having a safe and secure place to live in a changing America. More information on the Bloomington Revivalists can be online at their website, bloomingtonrevivalist.com. Those with questions can email the Bloomington Normal Community Land Trust at bncommunitylandtrust@gmail.com. A short note on a road closure. Starting at 6 a.m. this morning, there will be a lane reduction at South University Street between West Virginia Avenue and Harris Street at the bridge in Normal. The lane reduction is for sidewalk repair, the town said, and work is expected to be completed by 3 p.m. Friday, weather permitting. A map highlighting the closure can be found online at arcg.is/oturkerso. For more information, you can call 309-454-9638. Shoe chain merger faces skeptical court by Deanne Durbin. The largest proposed grocery store merger in U.S. history is going to court. On one side are supermarket chains Kroger and Albertsons, which say their planned merger will help them compete against rivals like Costco. On the other side are antitrust regulators from the Federal Trade Commission, who say the merger would eliminate competition and raise grocery prices in a time of already high food price inflation. In a hearing that started Monday, a federal district court judge in Portland, Oregon, will consider both sides and decide on whether to grant the FTC's request for a preliminary injunction. An injunction would delay the merger while the FTC conducts an in-house case against the deal before an administrative law judge. Kroger, based in Cincinnati, Ohio, operates 2,800 stores in 35 states, including brands like Rouse, Smith's, and Harris Teeter. Albertsons, based in Boise, Idaho, operates 2,273 stores in 34 states, including brands like Safeway, Jewel Osco, and Shaw's. Together, the companies employ around 710,000 people. Here's what to know ahead of the hearing, which is expected to last until September 13th. Why do Kroger and Albertsons want to merge? Kroger and Albertsons, two of the largest grocery chains in the U.S., announced in October 2022 that they were planning to merge. The companies say the $24.6 billion deal would hold down prices by giving them more leverage with suppliers and allowing them to combine their store brands. They say a merger would also help them compete with big rivals like Walmart, which now controls about 22% of U.S. grocery sales. Combined, Kroger and Albertsons would control around 13%. And why does the FTC want to block the merger? Antitrust regulators say that the proposed merger would eliminate competition, leading to higher prices, poorer quality, and lower wages and benefits for workers. In February, the FTC issued a complaint seeking to block the merger before an administrative judge at the FTC. At the same time, the FTC filed a lawsuit in federal court in Oregon seeking the preliminary injunction. Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul, along with Attorneys General of Arizona, California, the District of Columbia, Maryland, Nevada, New Mexico, Oregon, and Wyoming, all joined the federal lawsuit. Will Kroger and Albertsons close some stores if they merge? They say no. If the merger is approved, Kroger and Albertsons have agreed to sell 579 stores in places where their stores overlap. The buyer would be C&S Wholesale Grocers, a New Hampshire-based supplier to independent supermarkets that also owns Grand Union and Piggly Wiggly store brands. Kroger and Albertsons initially planned to divest 413 stores, but the FTC, that plan would not have allowed C&S to be a robust competitor. Kroger and Albertsons agreed to divest additional stores in April. Washington has the most stores that would be divested with 124, followed by Colorado with 91 and California with 63. What happens if the Oregon judge issues a preliminary injunction? If the preliminary injunction is approved, Kroger and Albertsons would likely appeal to a higher court, said Mike Keeley, a partner and antitrust chair at Axon, Veltrop, and Harkrider, a Washington law firm. The case could then move through the FTC's own judicial system, but since that can take a year or more, companies often abandon a deal before going through the process, Keeley said. Kroger sued the FTC this month, alleging the agency's internal proceedings are unconstitutional and saying it wants the merger's merits decided in federal court. In that case, filed in Ohio, Kroger cited a recent Supreme Court ruling that limited the power of the Securities and Exchange Commission to try some civil fraud complaints within the agency instead of the court. Be interesting to watch. And this one says, Eli's Coffee Shop to close in Mackinac. Eli's Coffee Shop's fourth and newest location will be closing its doors next week, after just shy of 2 years in Mackinac. This decision was not made lightly, and it comes after much careful consideration and reflection on the future of our business, owners Rachel and Weston Berchtold told in a statement that posted to Eli's website and social media on Friday. The Mackinac Coffee Shop at 116 South Main Street will close on September 6th, having first opened for business in September of 2022. The location is the former site of a Heartland Bank, and when Eli's moved in, they embraced the bank theme, using the original counter, opening the vault for extra seating, having safety deposit box as decoration, and repurposing the original drive-thru. The Mackinac Shop has been more than just a place to grab a cup of coffee. We have watched you use it as a gathering spot with old and new friends, as a cozy spot to work and study, and a place to start conversations about bettering your corner of the world. We are deeply grateful for the support and love this community has shown us from day one, the owners wrote. The Berchtolds said they share their sadness with the community, noting the friendships formed in the shop and its Tazewell County Village. We close our doors in 2 weeks, resting in the knowledge that we were able to be a bright part of this building's story and this community for the time we were able, they wrote. The shop in Mackinac was the fourth Eli's to open in central Illinois. The original one opened in Morton in 2005, a second location opened in Tremont in 2014, and the Metamora shop opened in 2017. The other locations, as well as the Eli headquarters and bakery hub in Morton, will continue to operate after the Mackinac closure. While this chapter is closing, we hope you'll continue to visit us at our other locations where the same quality, menu, friendly staff, and cozy atmosphere await you. We are committed to continuing our mission to build our communities through connections over great coffee, the owners wrote. And now a little bit of high school sports. New conference, old favorites. The new heart of Central Illinois Conference will be competitive. HOCIC Large, Tri-Valley. After winning 33 of 38 games this past three seasons, don't expect the Vikings to slow down. All-state and all-area running back Cole Klein rushed for 1,473 yards and 23 touchdowns last fall. Klein will also see time as a quarterback along with junior Ethan Moore. The Vikings have other offensive weapons in running back Lucas Filarski, wide receivers Kate Danko and Tommy Harris, and tight end Justin McNeely, James Julian, Kyle Reeser, and Adam Moore are among the Tri-Valley blockers. Klein and Filarski play linebacker with Danko and Harris in the secondary and Julian up front. Tri-Valley also boasts an all-conference kicker in Cohen Robinski. We return a lot on both sides of the ball, Vikings coach Josh Roop said leadership will be the key. Eureka! The Hornets will need to make efficient use of another athletic group after posting a 5-5 record in 2023. Execution and physicality will be two of the main keys to our success, said Coach Jason Bachman. We will need to utilize our team's speed to swarm the football on defense, and our ability to get people moved up front will also have a huge impact on our success. Eureka has a big play threat in receiver Ben Lapp, who had 2 return scores last season. Austin Gerber steps in at quarterback after the graduation of Dawson Dorn. And Brent Miller and linebacker Torrey Kupfer-Schmid are defensive stalwarts. The Hornets' kicking game is set with punter Lance Wiegand and place kicker Nick Arndt. El Paso Gridley. The Titans are in search of their 4th straight playoff berth and their first playoff win since 2017 after a 6-4 record last fall. EPG coach Tanner Benedict believes keys to a successful season are being physical at the point of attack on offense and defense, limiting big plays while we are on defense, and continuing to have sound special teams play. Instrumental two-way players for the Titans include tight end defensive lineman Ryan Kelsey, guard defensive lineman Dominic Rossoni, and tackle linebacker Lucas Schaefer. Deer Creek Mackinac. Hit hard by graduation losses, the Chiefs do return an experienced quarterback and senior, Chuck Hathaway III. Chuck is going into year four on the program, DMAC coach Jody Myers said. Cody Myers. He can change a game at any moment with his abilities. Other key players for the Chiefs figure to be receiver Max Eklis, offensive lineman Corey McCaw, defensive lineman Reese Watson, and middle linebacker Sean Denniston. Our varsity will have a lot of openings left by graduation for players to step up and take leadership roles, said Myers. Ridgeview Lexington. Coach Matt Barnes' Mustangs are posed for improvement after a 2-7 record last fall. Our strength is our speed and experience with 14 returning starters, Barnes said. A year ago, we started 20 players that didn't have a snap of varsity experience. So with 14 guys returning, we are hoping for a more polished group that has been in the moment. That group includes quarterback Drake Powell, who passed for 1,291 yards and 15 touchdowns, 592-yard rusher Owen Grice, and linemen Lucas Martin, Bryce Clout, and Joe Cheever. A linebacker on defense, Clout registered 108 tackles last season, and end Aiden Helming, 97. Barnes also has a solid special teams players in punter Miles Lanehart and punt returner Carter Cross. Clinton. The Maroons hope to make playoff appearances a habit after a 6-4 mark in 2023. Juniors Keaton Graves and Josh Bass are competing for the quarterback job and will contribute at receiver if not under center. Clinton coach Ron Bass likes his offensive capabilities with Dawson Thayer and John Smock up front, and receivers Colton Walker, Jack Webb, and speedy newcomer Anthony Westbrooks. Running backs Christian Hibbert and Wyland Ragers will get the bulk of the carries. Lineman Thayer, linebacker Logan Toms, and back Walker all earn all-conference recognition, while the Maroons' kicking game is in good hands with Jack Webb punting and Taylor Anderson kicking. The key will be taking care of the ball with less experienced offense this year, Coach Bass said. The defense brings back a good core of 7 returning starters. Logan Toms led the team in tackles last year, and Colton Walker led the team with interceptions. Tremont. The Turks have a reason for optimism after suffering through a 0-9 2023 campaign. We are a very physical team, and many returning players have playing time at the varsity level, said Tremont coach Bunny Prather. Our players know what it feels like to lose, which has driven their work in the offseason to not repeat what happened last year. The Turks will count on Blaine Williams, who will play running back, wide receiver, and linebacker. Brett Bain will be at quarterback with Jordan Balsimo at receiver. Free safety Luke Haley and lineman Moody Brewers are the other key defenders. And that's all we have time for on part 1. I'll be right back with part 2. Please stay tuned.